make sure you are a member so that you get the bonus show. Sign up at joinpacman.com. I will again restate my offer to you that if you sign up for a new, listen to the keywords here, a new full price yearly membership for $60. If you sign up and pay $1.80 for your first month, you don't qualify. Okay, this is new full price yearly. We will send you a free t-shirt of your choice. Just email info@davidpacman.com after signing up. Tell me the t-shirt style, color, and size you want, as well as your mailing address. We'll get those right out to you. We also are doing a January 1st midterm kickoff membership special. If you've been thinking about signing up and waiting for just the perfect time, everything has to align for you to sign up. This January 1st is a great day to do it. We'll be doing a huge membership special. We'll be notifying everybody on our newsletter by email on the morning of January 1st. So just get on my newsletter, a mailing list at davidpacman.com. And then as a final reminder, tomorrow we will be doing the rescheduled final town hall of the year. It'll be streaming live on the Pacman Live YouTube channel, 6 p.m. Eastern, 3 p.m. Pacific, tomorrow, December 28th. Hope to see all of you there. But for today, we will talk to you on the bonus show, and you can sign up at joinpacman.com to get
Dying RCT, the insane from way out.
Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in Techno Land? RCT Techno DJs in the house! Oh yeah, bringing you the only fat beats in Pittsburgh. Right here on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Word to your mother.
Fellow Americans, I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away. WRCT, live on the internet. Because why should Pittsburgh have all the fun?
DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
Nuclear Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Now,
you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz.
Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a soul.
RCT Pittsburgh. Meaty and full of flavor since 1949.
For those of you concerned with your health, go to new USDA organic product standards.
WRCT Pittsburgh, would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you fast music.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away. WRCT, live on the internet. Because why should Pittsburgh have all the fun?
Nuclear Holocaust. It's a very serious problem.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
But it's so exciting now to see young people especially talking about building a new world, recognizing that it's not about punishing this person and that person. It's about creating a new framework so that we do not have to depend on institutions like the police and prisons for safety and security.
The world-renowned author, activist, and professor Angela Davis joins us to talk about abolition, the power of movements, Palestine, Mumia Abu-Jamal, the pandemic, and imagining new worlds.
I still think that we need artists to show us the way toward a very different organization, economic, political, social organization of our world, and capitalism has to fall.
Today, an end-of-year conversation with Angela Davis. Plus, we hear imprisoned journalist Mumia Abu-Jamal remembering South African Archbishop Desmond Tutu, who visited him on death row, then called for his release. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Global coronavirus cases hit a record high Monday as the Omicron variant continued to spread at an unprecedented pace. Worldwide, countries reported nearly 1.5 million positive coronavirus tests in just 24 hours, with the rate of new infections rising rapidly in Southern Africa, Europe, North America, and elsewhere. France ordered new public health measures Monday, including a requirement people show proof of vaccination to enter restaurants and other public places. But French officials stopped short of a new lockdown and abandoned a push for a workplace vaccine mandate. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson said he will not introduce new COVID restrictions in England before the new year, despite a record 114,000 new cases reported Christmas Day. In Argentina, cases spiked to their highest level in 6 months and are increasing rapidly. In South Africa, COVID-19 cases have fallen by 40% in a week after the nation was the first to be hit hard by the Omicron variant. But cases are rising fast in neighboring countries, including Zambia, where only about 6% of the population is fully vaccinated. Israel's opened clinical trials looking into the safety and efficacy of a fourth shot of Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine. Israeli heart surgeon Jacob Lavi was the first to receive the jab Monday.
Well, I'm excited to be the first person, apparently in the world, who got the fourth booster of the COVID vaccine. To paraphrase an old saying, it's a small jab in the shoulder, probably a giant step for mankind.
Australia reported nearly 12,000 coronavirus cases Monday, by far its highest daily toll of the pandemic. Officials also reported Australia's first death from the Omicron variant. Here in the United States, the average number of daily coronavirus infections is poised to surpass last winter's record high, with nearly a quarter million new cases being reported each day. At the White House, President Biden met virtually with some of the nation's governors Monday, warning the Omicron surge threatens to bring shortages of hospital beds and ventilators. Biden defended his administration's moves to supply U.S. households with coronavirus test kits, but said more needs to be done.
But it's not enough. It's clearly not enough. If we'd known, we would have gone harder, quicker if we could have.
The Centers for Disease Control has reduced the recommended isolation time for people with asymptomatic infections to 5 days, down from 10 days. The move comes as the Omicron variant has sickened hundreds of thousands of workers, creating labor shortages in some essential industries. Meanwhile, top White House medical advisor Dr. Anthony Fauci on Monday suggested U.S. airlines should consider a vaccine requirement for all passengers and crew aboard domestic flights.
When you make vaccination a requirement, that's another incentive to get more people vaccinated. If you want to do that with domestic flights, I think that's something that seriously should be considered.
But Dr. Fauci later walked back those remarks, telling CNN he doesn't expect to see a vaccine mandate anytime soon. In Afghanistan, the Taliban has banned long-distance travel for unaccompanied Afghan women, saying they should not be allowed on the road unless they're escorted by a close male relative. The Ministry for the Propagation of Virtue and the Prevention of Vice also demanded vehicle owners to refuse rides to women not wearing headscarves. In related news, the Taliban last week dissolved Afghanistan's election commission. The panel supervised polls during the previous U.S. and Western-backed government. A Taliban spokesperson said, quote, there is no need for these commissions to exist and operate. Iran's entered an eighth and potentially final round of talks in Vienna aimed at restoring the landmark 2015 nuclear agreement, which former President Trump abandoned in 2018. Ahead of the talks, a spokesperson for Iran's foreign ministry said any new nuclear deal, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA, would have to guarantee the U.S. will not withdraw again.
We are in Vienna to reach an agreement at the first opportunity, a good agreement that guarantees the interests of the Islamic Republic of Iran and the Iranian people under the JCPOA, an agreement where we can be assured that the United States will not mock international rights once again.
Iraq's Supreme Court has ratified the results of October's parliamentary election, which saw the party of Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr win the most seats. The court rejected several appeals by Iran-backed Shia Muslim groups that contested the poll results, clearing the path for the new parliament to soon hold its inaugural session. In 2004, al-Sadr ordered his militia, known as the Mehdi Army, to attack U.S. forces occupying Iraq. In response, then President George W. Bush ordered the military to kill or capture al-Sadr, though the White House later canceled that order. U.S. and Russian officials are scheduled to hold security talks on January 10th amidst mounting tension over the military buildup at the Russia-Ukraine border. A Biden administration spokesperson said Russia and NATO are likely to meet January 12th and that a broader discussion, including Russia, the U.S., and other European countries, is also set for January 13th. Russia's blamed the escalating tensions over Ukraine on Western powers. Germany's new coalition government has moved to legalize recreational use of marijuana. A deal among the Social Democratic Party, Free Democratic Party, and Greens would see the creation of a regulated market for the adult sale and use of cannabis. The plan also calls for broader drug policy harm reduction programs, like allowing people to test illicit drugs for contaminants without facing criminal penalties. If the deal is approved, Germany will become the world's largest market for marijuana. Among European nations, only Malta currently allows for the recreational use of marijuana. President Biden signed a military budget bill Monday that'll see the Pentagon receive nearly $778 billion during the next fiscal year. It's a record high for a National Defense Authorization Act, surpassing the previous record set under Trump, and $24 billion more than the White House requested from Congress. Public Citizen's Robert Weissman blasted the bill as a reckless misuse of resources, adding, quote, why is there more money for the military-industrial complex, providing no additional protection for our national national security and arguably diminishing it. At the same time, the U.S. is refusing to spend the $25 billion needed to make enough additional vaccines to vaccinate the world, he asked. A warning to our audience, the following story contains graphic footage and descriptions of police violence. In California, the Los Angeles Police Department's released surveillance and body cam footage of the fatal shooting of 14-year-old Valentina Orellana Peralta last Thursday. The teenager was killed after an LAPD bullet bounced off the floor and into the dressing room where Valentina was trying on dresses with her mother. The footage shows about a dozen police officers entering the clothing store after receiving reports that a man was assaulting customers. Almost immediately after encountering the suspect in an aisle, one of the officers fired three rounds from an assault rifle, fatally injuring 24-year-old Daniel Elena Lopez, who was armed only with a bicycle lock. The officer did not make any commands, and Elena Lopez didn't appear to pose a threat to the officer. Valentina Orellana Peralta's death has been ruled a homicide due to a gunshot wound to her chest. The LAPD officer who killed her hasn't been identified and was placed on paid leave. Valentina died in the arms of her mother. Both had come to the U.S. from Chile about 6 months ago to be with Valentina's older sister in Los Angeles. The girl's aunt told the Los Angeles Times, quote, Valentina was a shy girl in Chile, but everything was turning out well for her in the U.S. My sister does not understand how this tragedy could have happened just when they had managed to reunite the family, the aunt said. And legendary poet, singer, author, and activist Patti Smith has been awarded a key to New York City. Smith's music has inspired countless bands and helped earn her the title of Queen of Punk. Her song, People Have the Power, has become an anthem at protests across the globe. Patti Smith has also been a longtime activist, performing regularly at anti-war rallies and political benefits. She gave an emotional acceptance speech during a ceremony Monday with outgoing New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio.
I kept thinking of what New York City has given to me. I came here in 1967 from a rural area of South Jersey. I had just a few dollars in my pocket, nowhere to stay, no real prospects. But I came here to get a job and to see what I could, to see what I was made of. And I found that the city, with all of its diversities and possibilities, if you're willing to work, if you maintain your enthusiasm, you'll make it.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
Dreaming, God knows, I feel of you.
Smith performing People Have the Power with Michael Stipe of REM at Democracy Now!'s 20th anniversary celebration 5 years ago at Riverside Church. She was awarded the key to New York City on Monday. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Well, this year we've been marking Democracy Now!'s 25th anniversary on the air. Earlier this month, Angela Davis, Noam Chomsky, Arundhati Roy, Martina Spada, Winona LaDuke, Danny Glover, Danny DeVito, and others joined us for a virtual anniversary celebration. You can watch the whole event at democracynow.org. Today, we bring you our full conversation with Angela Davis, the world-renowned abolitionist, author, activist, and professor at the University of California, Santa Cruz. Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez and I interviewed her from her home in Oakland, California. It's 25th anniversary celebration, Angela. It is such an honor to have you join us, as you've had done so many times in the last decades.
Well, thank you so much, Amy. You know, it seems like it's been longer than 25 years. It seems like Democracy Now! Has always been there, but I think I may also be thinking about I.F. Stone's newsletter and some, you know, other progressive media in your lineage.
Well, to be counted in that amazing pantheon, someone like I.F. Stone, who said to journalism students, if you can remember two words, remember government's lie. If you can remember three words, remember all government's lie. It would be an honor for us to be counted together with I.F. Stone.
Well, thank you so much for your work over the years. I was just reflecting on the fact that when no one else would cover Mumia Abu-Jamal, we were able to hear his voice on Democracy Now! And when no one else was thinking about Assata Shakur and the demonization of Assata Shakur, Amy, you and Juan and your colleagues were covering her case. So thank you so much. I don't know what we would have been able to do in our efforts to push for radical social change if Democracy Now! Had not been there.
Well, Angela, I wanted to ask you, when we first spoke on Democracy Now! About abolishing the prison industrial complex, that was back in 2010, and you said then that, quote, prison abolition is about building a new world. Here we are more than a decade later, the abolition movement has drawn more attention. What is key to understand about how this movement can continue to grow?
Well, you know, let's remember that the abolition movement has a very long genealogy. We can go back to the 1970s and the Attica Brothers uprising, people in prison there who rose up against the horrendous conditions also called for prison abolition. And this was perhaps the first time that there was this public display of a way to address the prison system that was not couched in the ideology of reform. I am absolutely surprised that abolition has entered into public discourse during this period. To tell the truth, many of my comrades and I assume that it would be decades and decades, you know, perhaps 50 years from now, people would finally begin to understand that we cannot keep attempting to reform the police or reform the prisons. Reform is actually the glue that has held these institutions together over the years. But it's so exciting now to see young people especially talking about building a new world, recognizing that it's not about punishing this person and that person. It's about creating a new framework so that we do not have to depend on institutions like the police and prisons for safety and security. We can learn how to depend on education and healthcare and mental health care and recreation and all of the things that human beings need in order to flourish. That is true security, true safety.
I wanted to ask you about another aspect of that movement as well. You're the daughter of civil rights activists. You went on to become a prominent member of the Communist Party USA, a leader of the Black Panther Party, and you were targeted by the FBI. At one point, the FBI had you on its list of the 10 most wanted fugitives in America. Yet today, some of the loudest voices within the young radical resurgence in America, especially on the college campuses and in middle-class intellectual circles, are openly dismissive or simply ignorant of the most vital lessons of the Panther Party, the Young Lords, and figures like Malcolm X, you, and W.B. Du Bois, who all urged the need not only to battle systemic racism, but also to strive for the solidarity of oppressed people of all races, for unity of workers against imperialism. But this new trend now, it seems to me, is focusing more on racial identity, individual biases, and anti-blackness as the central question for social change. And in doing so, they echo a historical strain of narrow nationalism, what we used to call in the Young Lords back then, pork chop nationalism, the Panther Party as well called it that. Some have even sought on social media to cancel you, and the lived experience and the sacrifices of radical socialists and the revolutionary movement within the Black and brown communities. I'm wondering your thoughts on that. I've heard you speak on it, I think, at a forum in Germany recently.
I'm very disappointed that we don't have a more capacious public understanding of what it means to stand up against racism. Racism is the very foundation of this country, based on colonialism and slavery. And that means, in the very first place, it is important to recognize the connections between indigenous people and people of African descent. It is not possible to tell the story of people of African descent in the Americas without also telling the story of indigenous people. I think that when we engage in serious conversations with young people who really want to learn, they begin to get it. They begin to recognize that we can't work with these narrow assumptions about blackness and who counts as black. And the efforts to dismiss what is often referred to as political blackness. And of course, Du Bois taught us so many decades ago that the reason for identifying connections and relationalities among African people and people of African descent has little to do with the biology or genetics of blackness, but rather has everything to do with struggles against imperialism, everything to do with global struggles for a better world. But of course, we continue those conversations, and I'm actually impressed by the fact that increasing numbers of people are recognizing how important it is to have a decolonial or anti-imperialist perspective. If we did not expect to have abolition become a central element of public discourse during the early part of the 21st century, and it has become that, then I think we can be a little more optimistic about the possibility of encouraging people to think more critically about the future struggles against racism.
Angela, I wanted to ask you about this latest news. The North Dakota's Republican governor, Doug Burgum, has signed legislation banning the teaching of critical race theory. So public schools are now barred from teaching students that, quote, racism is systemically embedded in American society. Critics say the law could ban the teaching of slavery, redlining, and the civil rights movement. Even discussion of the law that was just passed is now prohibited in North Dakota's schools. And you see this happening across the country. You know, I see Democracy Now! And overall independent media, one of its powers, aside from assuring that there's a forum for people to speak for themselves, is bringing historical context to everything. So when we talk about you today in 2021, you constantly go back in time and you look to the future. You talk about the struggles of the 60s and what's happening now. What about this movement, this against education in America?
Well, Amy, I think that what we are witnessing at this moment is a profound clash between forces of the past and forces of the future. Campaign against teaching critical race theory in schools. You know, first of all, critical race theory is not taught in high schools. And I wish more critical race theory were taught at the university level. But critical race theory has become a watchword for any conversations about racism, any effort to engage in the education of students in our schools about the history of this country and of the Americas and of the planet. Any discussions about slavery as the foundational element of this country are being barred according to the proponents of removing, quote, critical race theory from the schools. But let's not be misled by the term they are using. What we are witnessing are efforts on the part of the forces of white supremacy to regain a control which they more or less had in the past. I think that it is absolutely essential to engage in the kinds of efforts to prevent them from consolidating a victory in the realm of education. And of course, those of us who are active in the abolitionist movement see education as central to the process of dismantling the prison, as central to the process of imagining new forms of safety and security that can supplant the violence of the police.
And Angela, I'm wondering if you could talk about the growing threat of fascism and authoritarianism here in the United States. Clearly, the January 6th events, I think, were a wake-up call to those who hadn't awakened during the period of the Trump presidency. But the signs, not only in the United States, but in much of Western Europe, are that the right-wing fascist and populist right-wing populist movements and fascist movements keep growing. Your sense of how progressives and radicals can unite to beat back this tide here in the United States?
Well, of course, fortunately, we did manage to evict fascism from the White House. But I think that people are often a little too short-sighted and assume that by evicting the forces of fascism from the White House, that we had consolidated a victory. No, this is simply a skirmish, as Gramsci might point out, that we need to continue the effort to challenge of fascism that, of course, relies on racism in this country and white supremacy as the ways in which it expresses itself. There's Brazil, of course, and we see continuing efforts to challenge, you know, what the terrible forces of fascism have done in that country. I would suggest that here in the U.S., if we are serious about being victorious over fascism, that we have to have an internationalist perspective. We can't simply focus on what is happening in Washington. We can't simply focus on only on our domestic issues. We have to have a greater understanding of what is happening in Brazil, in the Philippines, in South Africa, in Palestine, throughout Europe. And of course, this is why we need Democracy Now. Democracy Now helps us to place our own domestic issues and struggles within the context of global battles against fascism, against climate change, especially against climate change, against racism. We're becoming aware that racism is not primarily a U.S. phenomenon, not primarily a South African phenomenon. It has infected our global atmosphere.
You know, you mentioned Palestine, Angela, and in 2019, you were very excited when the Birmingham Civil Rights Institute announced that you were going to get the Fred Shuttlesworth Human Rights Award. I mean, you come from Birmingham, and you are returning home, and it was going to be this big celebration. So we ended up following you back to Birmingham, but this was after the Institute rescinded the award, reportedly due to your activism around Palestine. I mean, this became a major brouhaha. In the end, thousands of people, and we covered this whole journey you took, came out to the convention center to hear you speak, to show their support. The Institute was disgraced. People resigned from the board. Ultimately, they reversed their decision. You did get the Fred Shuttlesworth Award. I mean, it was an amazing series of months, what happened. And I was wondering if you could talk about that and advice you have for others who've come under attack for their support of Palestine.
Well, Amy, that was actually an incredible experience, and I'm so excited now about the attention that Palestine has garnered in a place like Birmingham, Alabama. So many of the people who became involved in the effort to contest the decision of the board of the Birmingham Civil Rights Institute were not necessarily familiar with the struggles in Palestine, but in the process of recognizing that everyone deserves the attention of human rights activists. One cannot be in favor of human rights with the exclusion of certain communities or certain struggles or certain countries. And so I'm excited to recognize now that people who were not necessarily involved in the campaign for justice in Palestine have joined that movement. Black people, Jewish people, and as someone who's been involved virtually all of my life in struggles around Palestine, I'm as difficult as things remain, and we see the evictions continuing to take place, we see efforts to consolidate the rule of the Zionists, both there, in both in the region and throughout the world. But at the same time, there is, I think, more hope than we have experienced ever in the struggle for justice for Palestine. More people who are involved. And so I, at first, I was so disappointed when I discovered that they were rescinding that award. But now, I think in many ways that was a gift, because that generated conversation, and it generated renewed reflection, collective reflection on the absolute importance of focusing on justice for Palestine.
And we'll be back with scholar and activist Angela Davis in 20 seconds.
Say a prayer for me. Strange fruit come down off that tree. Cut it down under your feet.
This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As we return to our conversation with Angela Davis, the world-renowned abolitionist, author, activist, and professor, I interviewed her with Juan Gonzalez.
Speaking of reflection, you've been on Democracy Now! To talk about President Obama. You've been on to talk about President Trump, and then the Biden campaign as well. And you said in 2020, I do think we have to participate in the election, but noted that in our electoral system as it exists, neither party represents the future that we need in this country. So here we are now, 1 year into the Biden presidency, the battles over these various huge stimulus programs, including now Build Back Better. The progressives are battling over what they should do if the Build Back Better program is further eviscerated. Your counsel to the radicals and progressives about how they should deal with the Biden administration?
Well, you know, those of us who voted for Biden and Harris did not do so because we expected to follow them as leaders in our struggle. We could have predicted this moment now, but I think that what we have learned, especially since the mobilizations of the summer of 2020, is that history does not change because a few leaders here and there decide to take particular positions or decide to, you know, pass bills. And of course, I'm not at all trying to minimize the importance of electing progressives and radicals both to Congress and to local office. I'm not at all disparaging that, but what I am saying is that in order to make real lasting change, we have to do the work of building movements. It is masses of people who are responsible for historical change. It was because of the movement, the Black Freedom Movement, the mid-century Black Freedom Movement, that Black people acquired the right to vote, not because someone decided to pass a Voting Rights Act. And we know now that that victory cannot simply be consolidated as a bill passed, because there are continual efforts to suppress the power of Black voters. And we know that the only way to reverse that is by building movements, by involving masses of people in the process of historical change. And that holds true for the current administration.
Angela, we're still in the midst of the pandemic, and I'm wondering how it affected you over this past year and a half. As you talk about movements, it's so often it's people gathering, whether we're talking about the critical resistance conferences, the mass protests in the streets after George Floyd was murdered by the police. There were mass protests in the streets even during the pandemic, of course, but if you can talk about just personally what this meant for you, and if you feel like we've learned something, everything from respecting science, and that goes not only from talking about vaccines, but to climate change, the issue of vaccine inequity in the world, emphasizing those who have and those who don't have in so many ways, but then also personally, how you got by.
Well, Amy, I'm actually very fortunate in that I live in California. I live in Oakland. And I have access to the kind of technology that puts me in touch with people all over the world. So there are some things that I found really exciting about this terrible pandemic that claimed the lives of so many people, particularly Black and Indigenous and people of color and poor people more broadly. What I might say was a kind of gift that was offered us in the midst of, you know, all of this sadness and tragedy was the fact that we can communicate with people all over the world. And so I participated in conversations that never would have happened had I been compelled to travel in order to be involved in these conversations. So for example, a conversation in the Amazonas in Brazil that involved Afro-descended Brazilians, indigenous Brazilians, and people who are active in the struggle against police violence. So I think that there's some ways in which we consolidated our internationalism, of course not consolidated, but we were able to get engaged in the kinds of practices that allowed us to recognize how important those ties are. On the other hand, of course, we all need, human community. We all need the closeness and the touch of human beings, and that has been so difficult. I would also point out that I don't know whether we would have achieved this kind of awareness of the nature of structural racism. And I don't know whether so many people would have gone out into the streets at their own peril, of course, because in the summer of 2020, we were not really clear about the ways in which the virus is transmitted. But I don't know whether so many people would have felt compelled to go out and protest if we had not become aware of, as a country, and I'm talking about a good majority of the population in the country, of the realities of structural racism. And the impact of the virus taught us about the nature of structural racism as it had an impact on the healthcare system, as the virus claimed the lives of disproportionate numbers of Indigenous and Black people and people in the Latinx community. And that awareness helped to condition the response to the police lynching of George Floyd. And so as tragic as this period has been, as difficult as it has been to live without our the closeness of our community. As terrible as that has been, it has also offered us some gifts. And I don't know whether we would have experienced a situation in which more people than ever before in the history of this country went out in the streets and marched and protested and said no to racism.
Well, Angela, I wanted to ask you, you mentioned earlier on Mumia Abu-Jamal. In our early years in Democracy Now!, we were knocked off the air in a bunch of Pennsylvania stations as a result of airing his commentaries. I knew Mumia personally because we worked together as journalists in Philadelphia in the early 1980s. I'm wondering, he's continued to be in prison, turned 67 in April, is 40 years now in prison, has had COVID, heart surgery this year. Could you talk about his importance? He's one of the most famous political prisoners in the world. He has continued to have amazing commentaries and writings throughout his time in prison. Mumia's impact on the radical movement in America, and if you could talk about the pressing need to continue to demand his release.
Yes, thank you so much, Juan. I don't think we would be where we are today without the consistent and dedicated participation of Mumia Abu-Jamal in our struggles. First of all, I would say that Mumia is known all over the world. There are streets named after him in Germany and in France. He became the second person in the history of France after Pablo Picasso to receive an honorary citizenship in the city of Paris. And so that his importance is recognized elsewhere in the world, but because of the ways in which the police and the police benevolent order, the fraternal order of the police, because of the ways in which they have misrepresented Mumia and mobilized the entire police community all over the country against Mumia, he remains in prison after having served time for more than 40 years, including much of it on death row. What I would say now is that precisely because we have succeeded in making public critiques of the police, and of course we see them now trying to reconsolidate their power all over the country, but because there are these fissures in the power of the police, we should take advantage of that to intensify the campaign to free Mumia Abu-Jamal. I was just communicating the other day with Julia Wright, the daughter of Richard Wright, who has been so important in France in developing the campaign to free Mumia. And she and people all over the world want to see us bring the case of Mumia to the fore, especially now. Considering the fact that David Gilbert, who has been in prison almost a half a century, was released on parole recently, 2 weeks ago. We have to claim that victory and recognize that this is precisely the moment to demand more releases, to demand the release of Leonard Peltier, who has been in prison even longer than Mumia, and all of the political prisoners who remain behind walls.
people can go to Democracy Now! And see our interviews with Leonard Peltier. I know we have to wrap up, and it's very hard for me and Juan to stop this conversation. And we're going to talk to you again on Democracy Now! Your book is coming out again. It's being reissued, Angela Davis, an autobiography, which astoundingly was edited by Toni Morrison. We talked to you on Democracy Now! When Toni Morrison died. We talked to you when Aretha Franklin died. We tracked you down, I can't remember where. And it's amazing because while people talk about, you know, Aretha's great artistry, what people didn't realize is that she was involved with offering to post bail for you when you were in prison, saying black people will be free. And I'm wondering if you can reflect, we'll go much more extensively into this when your book comes out, on these relationships you have had and what gives you hope for the next generation of artists, writers, scholars, and activists, all of which you are rolled into one.
I think that having lived this many decades and having experienced what I have in the context of movements against racism and against heteropatriarchy, against imperialism, I am more committed than ever to using what talents I might have to developing movements for radical change. And you mentioned Aretha Franklin and the fact that she offered to post bail for me. That was a very moving moment in my life, and I have come to recognize how absolutely essential the role of artists has been and will be for our movements. This is a period during which musicians and visual artists, poets, writers are all using their talents collectively to create more possibilities for the kinds of conversations that will bring people into movements for justice, for freedom, for equality. And let me say one more thing, which unfortunately we haven't discussed during the course of this wide-ranging conversation, and that is the power of global capitalism. And I still see that I still think that we need artists to show us the way toward a very different organization, economic, political, social organization of our world. And capitalism has to fall.
Well, Angela Davis, we want to thank you so much for being with us. And I want to ask you finally about the issue of independent media, of people shaping their own narratives. I mean, I think that's the power of the corporate media, is they tell a story, whether it is true or not, brought to you by the weapons manufacturers every 5 minutes or the drug industry every 10 minutes, you know, the commercials, as you talk about capitalism. If you could talk about a different kind of media, in perhaps, if you want to imagine this, a post-capitalist society and what that would offer, since it's the way people can communicate with each other all over the world.
Well, I think it's so important now, Amy, to imagine new worlds. We cannot fight for those worlds unless we know how to imagine them. And independent progressive media, like Democracy Now!, help to inspire us in that project of collective imagination to allow people to tell their own stories. And of course, you go where the movements are unfolding. I'll never forget watching your arrest at Standing Rock and how that campaign helped to galvanize a more holistic understanding of what it is we're struggling for, the freedom that we're fighting for, that we have to save this planet. And indigenous people are the stewards of this land for so many millennia have taught us that that the struggle for the environment has to be central to our work, and you present their stories. So I thank you and Juan and all of your colleagues for the work that you continue to do, and I'm sure we'll be speaking to each other in the near future.
World-renowned abolitionist, author, activist, and professor Angela Davis. This is Democracy Now! We end today's show with the words of imprisoned journalist Mumia Abu-Jamal, remembering South African Archbishop Desmond Tutu, who died on Sunday at the age of 90.
Archbishop Desmond Tutu, 1931-2021. Almost a century ago, a little African boy was born to a small family in a small town where gold mining was the chief industry. The town was Klerksdorp, in what was then called the Transvaal. Father was a teacher, and the young boy wanted to follow in his father's footsteps. But the politics of white supremacy, known by the term apartheid, prevented him from making that choice. That policy, developed by the National Party after it won election in 1948, passed a law called the Bantu Education Act of 1953, legalizing racial segregation in schools. That state decision forced Desmond Impilo Tutu to change from teacher to preacher. A new history was written. Desmond Tutu studied, graduated, and was ordained an Anglican priest and began a steady climb in the church hierarchy, being named its archbishop in 1986, the Archbishop of Cape Town. As the anti-apartheid movement swelled in South Africa, so too did repression by the state, and with most militants from the African National Congress, or ANC, driven into exile, the Archbishop stepped into the breach, presiding over funeral after funeral, and giving voice to the black oppressed majority of the nation. He played a pivotal role in speaking out against the racist system of government, and suffered arrest and attacks by police tear gas at protests. Throughout it all, he stayed true to his religious beliefs, a committed Christian who saw all life as valuable. He preached for peace and reconciliation. He preached, too, for justice. He spoke out firmly against violence, whether by the government or the freedom movement, and as the profile of the little priest grew, so did his concerns for justice and freedom, even beyond the borders of South Africa. The Archbishop, lovingly called the Arch by his family, called the government violence, repression, and separation against the Palestinian people a new form of apartheid. He called for freedom for the Puerto Rican people from the United States government. He critiqued the suffering and state violence against the Muslim minority in Myanmar. And the little priest even visited a man on death row, where he wondered why a man had to be shackled in a little room divided by a glass window where the door was closed, shut, locked, and didn't even have door handles. The arch was quiet, serious, a ray of spiritual light in dark places, and a joy to meet. When apartheid fell in the 90s and South Africa became reborn as a democracy, Archbishop Tutu heightened his critique of the new black government, which he said was getting rich as the people got poorer and poorer. He was short, yes, but his spirit reflected a giant. His passage on this planet was a message of love for worlds oppressed, no matter where they were. He struggled for change with his prophetic voice, his sweet humor, his deep love, and a boundless sense of compassion. Desmond Nkilo Tutu, born October 7, 1931, returned to his father's after 90 summers, an example of love, not fear. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Prison Radio.
In prison journalist Mumia Abu-Jamal remembering South African Archbishop Desmond Tutu, who visited him in 2007 when he was still on death row. And that does it for our show. We continue our year-end conversations with National Book Award-winning poet Martina Spada on Wednesday, Noam Chomsky on Thursday, and on Friday we'll look back at 25 years of Democracy Now! Democracy Now! Produced with Mike Berkey and Augusta Messiah Rhodes. Remember, wearing a mask is an act of love. I'm Amy Goodman.
Teachers shape the future. Right now, in a classroom somewhere in the United States, there's a teacher inspiring a future scientist who'll make preventing pandemics their life's work. Sharpening the mind of an aspiring environmentalist who'll help combat climate change. And generating possibilities for a student who'll be the first in their family to graduate college. Explore a career that leaves a legacy you can be proud of. Teach. Learn more and receive free support at teach.org.
Hey, Pittsburgh, this is Eric Harrison coming to you with a heart full of gratitude on WRCT Pittsburgh. Rock on, Yinzers.